We have one more distinguished speaker to talk with us about a subject that's very near to my heart, and that's photography. I love taking pictures. I love old pictures. And really happy to have Mr. Teal here today to talk with us about it. And I know a lot of you are interested in photography also. But I'll tell you a little bit about Mr. Teal. He is a lifelong resident of South Carolina, and his name is Mr. Harvey S. Teal. He has a master's degree from the University of South Carolina. He's a retired educator, administrator, and former supervisor of instructional technology for the South Carolina Department of Education. He currently devotes his time to historical research. He is co-author of South Carolina Postal History, an illustrated catalog of postmarks, and also South Carolina Post Offices and Postmasters, and an expert in philately? Did I say
philately?
Philately. I'm not sure what that is, but maybe you can tell.
Stamp collecting.
Stamp collecting, okay. He has published a number of books, historical reference books. Recently, he spent 10 years researching and collecting photographs and history for his latest book, Partners with the Sun, South Carolina Photographers, 1850 to 1940, which was published by the University of South Carolina Press. So we're really happy to have here with us today Mr. Harvey S. Teal.
Is there a mic here?
No.
Nope. Oh, okay. Okay.
You're the mic.
Then I will get closer to you. Yeah, maybe we could just move this table. I don't need the rostrum. But you can move this table up a little closer because I want to.
Careful.
Okay. I never like to be separated from the audience anyhow very much, if you want to hear me. All right. Well, I used to teach school, so I can project some. I think there's one or two people in here I taught a few years ago. Who in here did I teach? Yeah, I see two hands up. That was at the time when you called what is today middle school, junior high. That was at Hand Junior High School in Columbia. Well, it's a pleasure to come down to Orangeburg because I had a pursuit, a hobby, still have, of collecting bottles. And I used to dig bottles down the hill near the swamp where there was the Orangeburg dump. So I've been near here many times. Of course, there's a story about bottle diggers that says they're happiest when they're down in the dumps. Maybe true. Anyhow, I'm very happy to be here, though, seriously, because I always like to meet with people who are interested in history and who have different pursuits in that area. And I want to talk to you this morning about using photographs in historical pursuits, especially genealogical ones. I have a son named Dennis. He was born in 1959. And along about when he was of the age when he thought his father could do no wrong, you know, and that I was his big hero, I came home one day and he asked me a genealogical question about the family. Let me give you a little background to that. I also have a nephew named Stevie. And his last name was McLaughlin. And, of course, my last name was Teal. And Dennis asked me the question when I came home from work. He said, Daddy, he said, when did the Teals come over here? I said, what do you mean? He said, to this country. And I began to explain something about the Teal genealogy coming into Baltimore, Maryland, and moving down to North Carolina, and then to South Carolina. And he said, That was not before Christ, was it? I said, no, I don't believe so. I said, why do you ask? He said, well, Stevie told me that the Mazatians came over here before Christ. Well, I realized then they had been doing one-upsmanship on me, talking about the family and so on. And I said, well, Dennis, you know the story of Adam and Eve. Yes, sir. I said, well, do you know what Adam's last name was? He said, no. I said, it's Teal. He said, hot dog, wait till I see Teal. So he was going to really have him then. Of course, you can make Adam's last name any name you want. It can be the name of everybody in this room. So you can short-circuit a whole lot of genealogy and a whole lot of study by just going to the book of Genesis. Well, anyhow, I suppose you could look upon photographs sort of fig leaves, too. Actually, we're going to turn some over today and examine them rather carefully because the photographs lack many other artifacts. If you want to put quotes around and call them the big leaves of history, you can do so. But anyhow, about 1990, I had completed, prior to then, a photograph of a postal history of South Carolina. And I was casting about for what I might offer to do next. I have volunteered since the 1950s at Carolina Library, University of South Carolina, and have done research there over the years. And I'm actually a volunteer field archivist for them. And over the years, I've brought in thousands of collections of photographs and papers and that sort of thing. And so I was aware of what had been done in terms of books written about manuscripts and books written about books and books on works of art on paper and all of those kinds of things. But as I surveyed the historical field, I observed that there were very few books that were written on photographers or on photography, and that historians would be very careful when they went to give credits in their books about the museum or the individual maybe who owned the photograph, but they would never say a word about who produced it. They would never mention the photographer's name. Go back and look at your books where there are photographs in it. Even today you will find this to be the case. The photographer gets no credit. So I concluded the photographers had become the Rodney Dangerfields of history. They just got no respect. And I thought, well, we need something that documents the photographers who worked in South Carolina from the beginning of photography up to, well, I didn't want to bring it up to the present. The book was published in 2001. And it took me 10 years to do it, but I decided I would just do a century. And with the state of South Carolina being the size it was, and as I got into the research and began to determine how many photographers about I would have, I figured I would come out with 600 or 700. And that proved to be the case. I think it's about 650. And if I had gone on through World War II, you know, it would have added materially to the content I would have had to cover, and you'd get beyond one volume. And besides, photographers in 1940 weren't operating much differently than they were in 1900. Actually, many of them used the same equipment. You can go to the old studios, and some of them in 1940 were still using the flash pan. You know, with a big camera, flash the light to get the light for the image. So anyhow, I decided I would do a century. 1840, essentially, when photography began. 1940. actually began in 1839 here in South Carolina with a professor at the University of South Carolina, South Carolina College at that time. Mr. Elliott, he was a professor of chemistry and mineralogy, and he was on the board of visitors of West Point. And he was in New York City when detailed descriptions of how you do a daguerreotype came in on the steamship in New York City on September the 20th, 1839. He went down and got one of these descriptions, went to a chemist shop on Broadway, and collected all the stuff he needed, and the next day went out and produced the daguerreotype. That's on September the 21st, 1839. So he was a pioneer in the field of photography from right here in South Carolina. In fact, that daguerreotype he produced on the 21st may be, it's no worse than the second one ever done in this country. I never expected to find anything like that when I started my project. But anyhow, the research for this project, I worked on it off and on for 10 years. I never entered into a contract with the University of South Carolina Press until I got well into my research, because I wanted to have most of it done before I committed to deadlines. And so I was going around and visiting all of the museums in South Carolina, because all of them have photographs. And I was going around to the public libraries. I was going around to the institutions of higher learning, because all of them have some photographs. And so I did all of that locally and went through carefully the photographic collection at the University of South Carolina. And then I began to branch out to the National Archives and to the National Portrait Gallery in Washington and to the Library of Congress and into some collections in other states. Now, I did all this on my own just because I thought it needed to be done. Nobody was backing me financially or anything like that. And I'm a retired educator, so I don't have real deep pockets, but this is something I thought should be done, and I enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed doing research. And in the course of doing this research, I ran across an organization that I decided I needed to become a member of, and that's the Daguerrean Society, a group that studies, collects daguerreotypes, which were the first photographs, basically, in this country. I knew by joining that society that has very studiously produced annual each year with articles in it on different topics concerning photographs. I knew by joining that society I would meet the major curators of photographs in the museums around the United States. I also knew I would meet the major collectors of photographs around the United States. So I made it my business to attend their meetings for about 8 or 9 years, to write papers for them that appeared in their journal, and to make presentations at their national convention. So when it got time for me to publish my book, and I wanted a copy of a photograph in somebody's collection or in some museum, they knew who I was and what I was about. And so it was quite easy, that facilitated getting images to put in your book. Most endeavors are done of some substance in depth are done by networking. It's very difficult. I hear all these people about, I did so-and-so. I'm a self-made man. That's a crock. We rely on each other, and it's foolish not to do so, because there are people who have more information than you have, and you get more if you give. That's a moral principle too. You get by giving. So, and I found that to be true many, many times, because I would give someone information about a photographer's background, I got it back many fold over, you know. So you get by giving. So my research also included looking at the school annuals, not for 100 years, but then start having them about 1900. See that the hag tone process had come after 1880, so you couldn't move from a photograph to a printing aid right away. You had to intervene with engraving. So you don't find photographs in newspapers or elsewhere much until probably about 1900. The process was first perfected in the 1880s. And as time passed, then you started seeing more and more photographs reproduced in publications and books. What you see before then are engravings, a print based upon an engraving. Somebody had to scratch on some kind of surface before you could print it, or you get the ink and put it on the paper. So that's a good thing to know, too, a good piece of information. So anyhow, I looked in those school annuals. That included high school annuals as well as college ones that might be in some museum or someplace, because a photographer who took photographs, he's going to have an ad in there. And so I picked up ads, and that was one way I could determine that a photographer had been at a particular place at a given time. And I also went to the newspapers, and I scanned, during the course of this research, most of the newspapers in South Carolina. I cheated some when there was a city directory for a particular period of year, because I figured if the photographer was in town, he would be in the directory. But maybe I should, at this point, tell you something about how I define a photographer. I have that far today. I'm in my outline here, but I define a photographer as someone who did a body of work at a particular period of time. Because the reason I say that, and also have studios, sometimes I included people who did not have studios because they did a great body of work. And most of the time, these are people who in part earned their living by photography. They were not amateurs. Many of them were itinerants. They moved about from place to place. And you can only pick them up from an ad in the newspaper that you know they were ever in town. Sometimes they were in town for only 2 weeks, 3 months. And then there were those who stayed for long periods of time. So if I could identify them as having done a substantial body of work, either in that town or in the towns of South Carolina, because some of them moved from one town to the other, I tried to track them with these ads I found, and I did so in the book and included that information wherever I could find it. And I titled the book Partners with the Sun. I had not given it a title, although I've been researching it for 7.5 years. And I ran across an article written by William Gilmore Sims on architecture in Charleston, and in his article, now mind you, he had, for his article to be illustrated, you had to have an engraving done of maybe a photograph that had been taken. So the daguerreotypes of buildings in Charleston had been made, and engravings from those photographs had been made, and that had been used to print his article. I believe it was in Harper's in 1856. And so he was describing the photographer. And let me add one other thing. At this time, photographers didn't use artificial light. They used the sun. And they tried to get buildings with sun with the skylights in where the natural sun could come in. Some of the northern photographers came in here and worked during the winter because they didn't have a whole lot of sunshine up north at that time, or shorter days, and they'd come south. But anyhow, he remarked on the photographers who took the daguerreotypes upon which engraving had been made and printing done. He said, it looks as if they had a partnership with the sun. I said, that's my title, Partners with South Carolina Photographers, 1840 to 1940. So that's how the book was done. I organized it, I already told you, 100 years, and I started in 1840. And I found, through my research, the number of photographers that were there, and I organized the book by decades. I took 1840 to 49, the very early photographers. And I then separated the photographers out by cities or towns. And then I included photographers underneath each town by the dates they operated in the town. So that's the way the book is organized. In each chapter, if there was a new photographic process that was developed during the time, I gave a synopsis of that photographic process, beginning with the daguerreotype. Now, I am not a photographer and not a scientific person. I taught social studies. Wasn't that great at math. I wasn't interested in it, except the balance sheet checkbook and, you know, those kinds of things. But anyhow, I described the photographic process. At the same time, Daguerre perfected his process. William Fox Talbot also developed a paper process. But Daguerre required, Fox required you, Talbot required you to get a license to his process. The French government bought up Daguerre's process and put it in public domain. Anybody could become a daguerreotypist, and you didn't have to pay for a license to do so. Consequently, it caught on in the United States much before the paper photographs did, but they were developed approximately at the same time. A paper photograph as well as the paper process as well as the daguerreotype process, which is quite different. So, and these processes started with the daguerreotype and a paper photograph. And then you got an ambrotype, melanotype, ferrotype, or tintype, and those three are the same. The French is part of melanotype, and it's actually ferro, it's iron, it's not tin. The tin type is not, it's really not tin, but that's what it started to be called, was the tin type. So in my book, you can go through it and find out when different kinds of photographs were being produced. Now, I'm pointing all this out to you because if you know your photograph in, how many of you here do not have photographs from the 19th century or family? You all got them, don't you? Or just about. Everybody got some. Have you had questions about them?
Yes.
Who is this? Yeah. And how are you going to find that out? Well, we're going to get more into that in a moment. Anyhow, but those processes are detailed along with the book. So as you read it, you get over time the development of photographic processes and new innovations in photography along with the people who were doing it. And that's arranged chronologically over time. And on your handout in my book, I include, I abstracted this out and I included a list of photographers that I found from Orangeburg. And I'm sure you probably have, some of you in here have photographs from some of these people. But I found fewer photographers from Orangeburg because Sherman came through here and he burned up a lot of records about the newspapers and other things that might have identified many more photographers for me. And in some towns you have lots of photographers who took out ads and what have you. And so it's It's a mixed bag across South Carolina what I was able to find, but I reported what I was able to find. And I would also like to report to you, since 2001, there's only been 10 or 12 more that have been identified. So I turned over a lot of fig leaves in the course of researching the book. Now, the definition of a photographer, I've explained that pretty much for you, that hindrance and what have you. Now, let's go to the topic of using photographs for genealogical purposes. The first thing I think you would want to do is look and see what kind of photograph it is, because that's going to give you an approximate date. If it's a daguerreotype, it's got to be likely from 1840 to no later than 1860. Likely earlier than that. There were not many daguerreotypes in 1840 being taken in South Carolina. So you can almost move up to about 1842 to 43 before you get great proliferation of these itinerant photographers moving around taking photographs. So more likely 1842 to 1843 to about 1857, about 12 or 13 years. The reason I say that, in 1859, the amber type was first taken in South Carolina, and most photographers in the next two or three years shifted from taking daguerreotypes to producing ambrotypes, which is a photograph on glass negative. And then, also in the 1850s, you had the tintype coming out, and then you had, in the late 1850s, you had the carte de visite. That means a visiting card-sized photograph. That's French. These guys. This one happens to be a cow. They usually didn't get photographed cows. Most photographers were studio photographers, and they didn't go out on location. Most of their early photographs are of people. To find a daguerreotype of a building or something like that. For example, I have seen less than a dozen daguerreotypes of buildings in South Carolina. There was no percentage for a photographer to run, pack up all this stuff and run around somewhere to take a daguerreotype. When you could sit in your studio and you folks came in and got your pictures taken. No point in doing that. So mostly you find portrait work early on. It was much later before you found a whole lot of other kinds of photographs. As these began to be produced, and you got a whole bunch of them, what you going to do with them? Well, the entrepreneurs came out with albums for carte de visite. This is kind of an album they had. This is from the Northeast, and most of the photographs in here are either, some of them are tintypes, but most of them are paper photographs that date 1860 to 65 or 67. Here's a Union soldier over here, where I have it laid out there. And speaking of albums, the albums of Mary Barton Chestnut have just been published. How many of you have seen those? Well, if you look in there, I was able to help in the research of that and found out who owned those albums after they got away from the family. And that's detailed in the book. And I found that out because I'd helped someone. A man from West Virginia called me and wanted some information. I gave it to him. And I said, by the way, you heard about those May Party Testament albums? So, and I told him about it. He said, well, that's interesting. And that's all he said. Well, the family was just about to die to find out where these things had been. About 3 weeks after that, he called me back and wanted something else. And he said, oh, by the way, you mentioned those Mary Barker Chestnut albums. Would you like to know who owned them and put them up for auction? I said, would I? He said, my hag brother. So you get lucky. Look what came back to me, because I didn't charge the man a civil question I could ask him. And so I got this back, and whenever we met with the family, and we called the person along, and we got the whole history of what had happened to them over about 30 years. And that's included in that book. So the type of photographic process, and they reference books on this, and the name of the photographer frequently appear on photographs, especially after you got paper photographs. And so you can turn to my book and see when he was in your town. How many of you in here have already done that and have been able to identify an ancestor that way and give an approximate date? I'm sure many of you have already used it in that fashion. I know someone talked to me beforehand. Once you got the paper photographs, it's much easier for the photographer then to print his credit on the paper and use it. Have you ever tried to date a photograph for the type of clothing? Well, it's a reference book, and I listed it here on your handout. There's a lady by the name of Joan Severo. Or did I list it on your handout? No, I did. I got it. Well, let me tell you her name. Joan Severo is her name. You can Google her and find out how you spell that. S-E-V-E-R-A. And it's called Dress for the Photographers. And she divides the book into decades and talks about women dress, men dress, and children dress. Okay? And so if the lady in your photograph's got a particular kind of hat, you look in Joan Severo's book, she'll tell you the years when that was in fashion. So it's quite helpful in dating photographs by using the content of the photograph. And in this case, we're talking about clothing. Now, there are many other things in a photograph that might help you date it. If it's a soldier and he's got a particular kind of weapon or a particular kind of uniform, that might help you date it. There's a whole host of things that you can examine in photographs, and it leads you into further research in other sources. In the case of daguerreotypes and case images, how many of you have case images at home? You know, like this. I'm sure lots of you do. And if you're doing research on the family, you have seen them in other collections. Well, how are you going to find out about the cases? When they were produced and how and all that sort of stuff. Well, I personally own this huge tome, and it's a weighted thing. And it's 19th century photographic cases. If a case has been manufactured in the past, Paul Bird has recorded it in here. There are just literally hundreds and hundreds of cases of different size and shapes and the different designs that you find on them. There's one case that has the potato dinner, Francis Marion and potato dinner. Is the subject matter on the front of one case. I purchased one time at the National Show and brought it back and said, tear it in the library now, because they didn't have one in their collection. But this book, it's 19th century photographic cases and wall mounts, by Paul K. Berg, B-E-R-G. By attending those, the Gage Society conventions, I know John Silvera. I know Paul Berg. I've been at meetings with him and had extended conversations over the years with him, see. So that was another value of meeting authors and researchers and people who were in the same field that I was in, or what I was doing at that particular time. So using the cases as a way to date the photographs, using the mounts around the cases or around paper photographs, using information that's on the paper photographs. I was in an antique shop, and they will have frequently stereographs, which is another photographic process. And there's information on when stereographs were produced. I saw in the back of this and said, they're in expedition. And that was all. Well, I happened to know what the Darien expedition was. And it was an expedition down to Cartagena. And this is the stereograph from that expedition. I believe it was Gardner who took that. I think it's 1869. So by information I had gleaned and looking at the back of this, I was able to get a historical photograph for a book simply by that piece of information that had been written on the back there in it. Studio furniture, posing chairs. You're apt to find them repeated in different photographs. Your photograph, you got this particular kind of chair, and you don't have a date on it. You find another one with a date on it. And then the name of the photographer. And you go look in my book, and you can date it. Sometimes it's even things like the tile on the floor, the pattern, big square tiles arranged in a certain way. It shows on one photograph is dated and the name of the photographer. And you got one that's undated and no name of the photographer. You say, well, that was done by Quinby and Charleston. So you can identify the name of the photographer. Then you have another piece of information you can use to go. So these tea leaves, you look at them carefully and closely, and it will lead you into maybe finding out more about your photograph. Now, you use sources of information from a variety of sources, along with the photograph itself. And on the back of your handout, I'm going to show you some examples of what I'm talking about. The top left is a photograph taken by Richard Wern, who was the foremost Columbia photographer during the Civil War. Prominent photographer right before the war, and he continued there until 1874. He committed suicide in January of 1874, and he's buried at First Baptist Church. I'm a member of that church, and the church historian, so I walk by Richard Wern's tombstone about every day when I go into church. But anyhow, he was in Columbia, and in the spring or early summer of 1865, he took this photograph looking down Main Street after Sherman had burned it. on February the 17th, 1865. Down below is the same shot with your back to the State House looking north. This is taken by a Yankee photographer, George N. Barnard. George N. Barnard was with Sherman's army in Georgia and in Tennessee, but he didn't stay with the army when he came through South Carolina. So he could not have taken it when Sherman's army came through. He had to do it later. Well, by additional research, when I was writing my book, I found out Barnard had taken the leave of absence and had gone home on furlough when Sherman started in South Carolina. So there was no photographer documenting Sherman's march through South Carolina. The only photograph of Sherman's troops in South Carolina was taken by a Union photographer who was now in Buford when they, some elements of that army camp right nearby. And he took some photographs of them in tents. That's a Union photographer who documented that. All the rest of his march through South Carolina was undocumented. Barnard came back to Charleston in March of 1865 and took photographs down there, you know, after Charleston's fall. And he later would come back and be a photographer in South Carolina in Charleston. But he did not take this photograph until June of 1866. This is 15 months after the fact. Okay, and I found all this out by tracing Barnard when he was doing another book in 1866. He was at, I placed him in Atlanta, Georgia, in Augusta, Georgia, like early June, and then a couple of weeks later, he's in Charleston. The only time he could have taken it would have been in that window. That's the only time he was ever in this vicinity. So by additional research from other sources that you bring to bear upon a photograph, then you can learn and assess it, learn a whole lot about it, and assess it much, much better. And so when I went into the Confederate Reddick room and I saw Barnard's photograph up there, the Yankee photographer, and I did not see Richard Wern, the Columbia Confederate photographer's photograph up there, I asked why. Well, I don't think at that time they were aware. One major difference is you can see a little buggy down in the bottom there. That was Barnard's little buggy. There's not one up here in this one. Sometimes those photographers had what's called a watch it, little wagon, a buggy. It's kind of a portable dark room. And it was a peculiar looking thing, and people would say, "What's that?" or "What's it?" So it became known as a "What's it?" But anyhow, that will illustrate how you can use resources or information in history as you study a photograph to assess what it really is and what it means. A Yankee photographer, a Union photographer, one taken in the spring or early summer of 1865, and the other was taken a year later. Okay. So for historical reasons, that becomes rather important. The top right, those are sweetgrass baskets. I received a catalog at home one day, and I looked down and said, "My God, those are sweetgrass baskets taken by a Union photographer in 1862. I've never seen a photograph that early of sweetgrass baskets." I said, "That would be a good documentation of those things." I called him up. I said, "Is number 25 available?" He said, "Yeah, I still got it." I said, "I want it." Well, he had a whole bunch of others, and I said, "If you give me the Monday, I may take all of those. Would you hold them to that long?" I needed to go down to Carolina Library and see if they had them. And I called him Monday, and I took them all. He said, that photograph of those wheatgrass baskets must be pretty good. I said, well, it's okay. I said, why do you say that? He said, well, I had 10 calls on it after you called, wasn't it? So it is the earliest documentation of a craft in South Carolina, which becomes significant in the study of those crafts. Down below is another story. This actually was the same dealer. He called me up and he said, Harvey, said, did y'all have a governor down there by the name of Bennett? I said, yes, we did. He said, do you know when he was governor? I said, I don't recall offhand. I think it's in the early 1820s. I can look it up for you. He said, why do you ask? He said, well, I've got an archive of a painting. And on the inside of the case, it says Governor Bennett of South Carolina. By the way, you should look underneath the cases, because your family member some time ago may have written who it is. So you need to take the image out of the case, but do it carefully. If you want, I can talk with you about how you might do that later. So I said, well, if it's a Governor Bennett, yeah, I want it. He told me how much it was. And I was going to be in Washington the following week. And I said, why don't I look at it while I'm there? And if it's Governor Bennett, yeah, I'll just pick it up. Well, he overnighted it to me anyhow. And so I looked at it, and we went down to Carolina. And they had a cart they was eating. Like this, a Bennett, who was an old man with bald heads. But you could look at the two and tell it was clearly the same person. And so I examined further as to whether or not anyone knew where a painting of Governor Bennett was, likely made while he was governor of South Carolina. Couldn't find the painting anywhere, but found some very interesting information otherwise. Found the painting of Governor Bennett's mother, done by the man who invented the telegraph, Samuel F. D. Morse. A painting by Morse of Governor Bennett's mother. Well, now, who do you think painted the governor? It had to be Morse. Well, I didn't tell that dealer what I had found. I just gave him a check and got the daguerreotype. So, you now have a daguerreotype of a painting which shows you the likeness of the governor of South Carolina from 1820 to 22. That you would not have otherwise if all of this had not been put together. Additional sources of information you use from history and from what you learn as you study photographs. And so it's now at the Carolina Library and it's illustrated in my book. So that's an interesting story about how you are able to do research using photographs in history and using them to date your photographs and find out who your ancestor is. Well, let me stop and I'll answer questions that you have. I haven't been checking the watch. I don't know how time to go in, but we're running pretty close. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
One quick one. The time periods, the dates that you alluded to in South Carolina, they pretty much match the rest of the country?
Yes, they do. One thing I discovered as I did my research, the quality of the photographs being done here were just about as good as those being done anywhere else, because two things contributed to it. They were using the same kind of chemicals. The southern photographers imported chemicals from the north because we were an agricultural society. We were not manufacturing much. We were not manufacturing these things, so we imported them from the north. So the materials being used were the same. Frequently, the photographers were the same, because many of the Union northern photographers came down here in the summer, in the wintertime. And I explained about the skylights and the sun. So you will find the same photographer in New England that you find in South Carolina. So the quality then was generally about the same all across the country. Their training was about the same. Now, while we're talking about training, early on there were no students teaching photography. It was an internship, generally. One photographer worked with another one. And that's how the knowledge was passed around from one to the other. All right, other questions? Yes.
So, the Carolina, what, you know, if we had photographs that people were willing to donate, this question comes up periodically. Mm-hmm. What range of interest does Carolina have?
Well, I'll give you some history of photographic collection in South Carolina. When the WPA came along, a part of it was a Federal Writers Project. The Federal Writers Project was headquartered in Carolina and Lafayette. So their records were there. One of the things they did was collect photographs to use to publish the guide to South Carolina and other things, the tours, you know, done by the WPA. The guides, the tours. And so when they folded, their collection remained in Carolina and became a part of that. They collected postcard views, all that sort of stuff. And it remained there. They collected by people, places, and things. So that became the genesis of the collection in Carolina. As time passed, photographs would come in manuscript collections that families gave the library. And so the collection began to grow. Now there was Dr. Robert Lee Meriwether's wife, Margaret Meriwether, was a volunteer. There was nobody assigned to do this. She was a volunteer who put that collection together and who would add to it when photographs came in. Eventually, especially after I wrote my book, and we began to call more attention to photographs and their importance as historical documents and artifacts, there is now a person whose sole duty to Carolina is to be the curator of photographs and works of art on paper. Her name is Beth Bilderback, and she has been assigned that sole duty. The collection at the Carolina Library now is an extensive, massive collection of photographs. I'll give you one example of how sometimes you can add great numbers at one time. Oh, by the way, the Mayor Walking Chestnut album is in Carolina Library. The family just gave those to us a year or so ago. And I'm originally from Churchill County. I grew up on a farm outside of Camden, and I've known that family for low these many years, and they have asked me to do a variety of things over the years, one of which was to make the opening remarks when acknowledging Mary Barkin Chestnut's nomination into the Hall of Fame at Myrtle Beach. That was a great honor they bestowed upon me for me to do that. And so I worked with the library and them on getting those albums there. But we mentioned stereographs. A friend of mine had been collecting stereographs for 30 years. He called me up one day. He said, Harvey, he said, you know, I'm going to sell my stereograph collection. And these were all South Carolina stereographs. I said, you are? I said, what do you want for it? He said, well, I just want what I paid for over the years. I thought, well, that would be one deal, because I'm sure 30 years ago he bought stuff worth $1 and that probably worth $100. And I said, well, what? Have you run the tab up on it, how much it'd be? He said, no, but it'll probably run $40,000, $50,000, or $60,000. I said, run the tab up. So he did. It came out to be $53,000. I went to Alan Stokes. I said, Alan, here's a deal we absolutely can't turn down. And so we got the, and we have a person who's on the board of the Caribbean Society. Wait for you. And we called the meeting of the board of the Caribbean Society and voted unanimously to take the funds of the society and to purchase this collection of 856 of South Carolina's aircrafts, many of which were of war of the Civil War. Actually, probably worth like $100,000 instead of $53,000, but he was selling them for what he had in mind. At that time, we had 250 stereographs in our total collection. So in one fell swoop, with one purchase, we were able to increase the number of stereographs, South Carolina used stereographs, more than fivefold. So that's how you gradually build a collection, and you get a, you know, an archive of photographs. And now you can go there and see all kinds of things about photography that you could not have seen 10, 15 years ago. And I do think I was instrumental in helping get this done by doing the research on this book and of it being published. And the library worked with me on that. Let me tell you, they allowed me to use everything in the library free of charge. And then we shared the royalties from the book. Hey, it went to the library table. But you never make any money off of a book like that. It's just a labor of love. I would have kept it in the city of ours. I did it because I wanted to do it. Okay. Yes.
What was the time frame of those pictures about this big that all of us have of our ancestors that are kind of like tall? I think it looks like tall.
That you hung in the front parlor?
Yes.
1890s to 1910 or so.
Okay.
Yeah, they are usually hand-painted or crayon hand-painted photographs on curved glass.
Yeah.
Everybody's got ancestors hanging somewhere in the house.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah,
I would say
1890s to 1910 or 1915. Other questions? Well, I do. If someone wanted a copy of my book, I have a few here. I've done other books. After I did the Partners with the Sun, I told you about Digging Dad here. This is a book on the South Carolina Dispensary, which is a very detailed history of the dispensary itself, plus photographs of the bottles. And lots of information, even Orangeburg information, for example, tells when you had local dispensers down here, dispensary booms in Orangeburg. It tells you which glass houses produce the bottles for the state of South Carolina. They were actually 21. I have that. And then a friend of mine and I did a book on pottery in Kershaw County. And that actually took back to before the Revolution, because a potter working in Camden in 1774. And there's a book on that up here. So if you want one, I'd like to tell you one. And then there are examples of these photographs up here, and if you want to come up and take a look at them, or if you want to look in the Bird book on cases, I'll be happy to do that too. Okay?
Thank you very much for such a delightful talk. I really learned a lot today. We appreciate you being here with us.
Glad to be here.